Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Folks can apply at any time throughout the year. There are certain times where we open up the windows to actually have an intake process. So that's what we have open right now. It closes on January 31st.
Allison Thompson with Foreign Ag Service on applying for the Ag Trade Advisory Committees.
If folks are interested in applying, they should definitely go to our website at www.fas.usda.gov and click on Trade Advisory Committees for more information or to apply. In order to apply, obviously, one must have expertise in international trade. There are also other stipulations. For example, you must be a U.S. citizen, and you also will, if selected, have to qualify for a security clearance.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
If you look at it from a production standpoint, it was a good year.
That comment may actually have some producers around the country scratching their head. The director of brokerage at Allendale is Greg McBride and says,
now, not everybody had a great year or a good year, but it, you know, overall, the averages came out to where they needed to come out at. It wasn't a failure. We started out the year kind of on shaky legs. Those markets, the corn and beans especially, saw the market just continue to trend lower, essentially from December 31st of 22 until mid to late May. And a lot of it was concern over what was going on in the world markets. Where was the demand? Because we'd seen Brazil pick up that deal with China to ship them corn, and so we lost all sorts of demand that way. But then it turned to, oh my goodness, we're never going to raise a crop, right? We were dry as a bone here in the Midwest for a long time. The South had their issues. Some areas were way too wet. Some areas were way too dry. But overall, it was one of those years where you just didn't know what you had. We started to get a little bit of rain here and there, but this also shows kind of the toughness of the genetics that we've grown over the last 10 or so years. Ever since that 2012 drought, the genetics have gotten so much better that we can withstand diverse weather conditions and adverse weather conditions the way that we saw this year. So we did end up with a decent crop overall in the corn and the beans, and even the wheat did okay. So we ended up with a decent year from a production standpoint.
And he says this is a big month.
We're going to start in January. We're going to do our Ag Leaders Conference. We're going to be talking about marketing for corn, beans, wheat, cattle, hogs. We're going to have a big weather presentation from Drew Lerner. So we're going to talk about everything to set up producers for the first 6 months of the year, at the very least, letting them get to know what the overall weather looks like. How is El Nino going to play into this, and give you an idea of how to finish out marketings from last year, and then how to start your marketings for the 24 crop.
Online, allendale-inc.com.
The American Farm Bureau Federation has a myriad of policy priorities for the new year. AFBF President Zippy Duvall says the top priority is getting a farm bill passed in 2024.
Well, it's critical that Congress pass a bipartisan farm bill early this year. We can't afford any further delays in getting an updated farm bill that would address our modern challenges facing our farmers and ranchers across America. Farm bill matters well beyond the farm. It addresses food security, sustainability, to nutrition programs, and all of these programs benefit the nation as a whole.
AFBF will host the American Farm Bureau Convention January 19th through 24th in Salt Lake City, where other 2024 priorities will be established.
The priorities will be determined by our voting delegates later this month at our annual convention in Salt Lake City, but we will continue to work with Congress to address the labor challenges facing our farmers. We have a labor shortage and unsustainable wage rate hikes that really are the biggest limiting factor to the growth of American agriculture. We also need to create new and expand the current trade agreements. And we have resolved to keep defending farms and ranches from the burdensome overreach of regulations from our federal government.
Duvall says there's still time to plan your trip to attend Farm Bureau's annual convention.
At this convention, it'll give them a great opportunity to hear from inspirational speakers, fellowship with other Farm Bureau members, and even become a new member of our organization. We have a great story to share about agriculture, and that story will be on full display at Salt Lake City.
Michael Clements, Washington.
Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Livestock producers are a very important part to American agriculture.
Marcia Bunger is the administrator of USDA's Risk Management Agency on a new weaned calf risk protection program.
We, at RMA, looked at ways to improve and expand insurance options to help with their needs. And I think this is a result of just that with the weaned calf. Like you mentioned, we have a number of other livestock products that we've seen a tremendous amount of growth with utilization of those products. But then again, we have not in the past had really a product for the cow-calf producer. And so through the 508H process, we have now been able to announce and roll out weaned calf. So like you said, it is only in 4 states, and you know, we want to make sure that we get it right. And so that's why it's being piloted in a limited area. But I certainly hope that there is some interest and at least some initiative to take a look and learn more about it, even if you don't decide to buy it this year.
She also talks about the importance of partnerships.
While we are not similar to FSA and NRCS as far as customer facing, we do have 10 regional offices across the country that you, I would encourage anybody to reach out to your specific regional office if you have questions or concerns. We also have a wonderful partnership with our private partners, the insurance companies, and our crop insurance agents. So, you know, there's a number of avenues to reach out and discuss, talk to people that are experts in the field. And so, we get great feedback that comes up through our regional offices with producers contacting those folks, but as well as we get feedback from crop insurance, livestock agents, our crop insurance companies. It's just a continuing evolution of the information that flows back and forth.
Not only the importance of partnerships, but of ag lenders as well.
While USDA RMA doesn't require the purchase of any of these products, many times, and I'm speaking from personal experience, many times my lender does. And it's the ag lending sector of this country that plays a very integral role in how we continue to operate from year to year. And so I think, you know, when I was talking about all of the partners, I was remiss and didn't mention our bankers. Our bankers are a wonderful source of information. You know, they know your operation specifically. You know, they pull up your operation and take a look at it. And I think they can also provide some valuable insight to what kind of coverage they think you should have based upon your debt load, your input costs. So that would be probably what I would like to add. When people start to talk about their own operations, it's private. And I know sometimes you don't feel very comfortable just talking openly about your own finances, but I know that you can't be shy when you have to go in and borrow money. So please involve your ag lender as well in these conversations.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
First question that we want to address, since most of us are in a spring calving operation, is our calving toolbox full on inventory, and do we know where it is?
Dr. Mark Johnson, Oklahoma State University beef breeding specialist.
It's always bad if we approach calving season, and at the point we figure out we need to be assisting that first calf heifer, that's when we start looking for our OB chains. So let's make sure that the calving box, that toolbox full of everything we need, is on hand and ready to go. Second, along with that, do we have colostrum on inventory? Colostrum is very important. Third thing that we want to address, are we prepared for the spike in cow energy and protein requirements that's going to happen once she calves and as we face wet, cold weather, potentially through calving season? Next question that we address, what is our marketing plan for the set of calves that we're going to have born this upcoming calving season. And relative to that, as we look ahead to that marketing plan, does that need to impact the type of bulls that we identify to use this calving season? And along those lines, are we capturing the full genetic potential of our calf crop relative to our marketing plan? Or is the genetic potential of our calf crop limiting the profit potential of our operation? All those questions tend to go hand in hand. Next question we should address, we're still working our way through drought in Oklahoma. Are we in a situation at present that we are managing for the long-term sustainability of our grazing ecosystem? That being the soil, the plants, as well as the cattle. And the final question, are you capitalizing on the educational opportunities that permit you to be a better manager in your operation? One example I throw at you, this May 22nd and 23rd here in Stillwater, OSU will host our cattle conference, the Blueprint for the Future, Part 2. More information on that cattle conference can be found on the SunUp website. But that and other opportunities are what permit us to not only plan, but to be continual learners and do the best job possible of adding profit potential to our cow-calf operation.
And it won't be long before we're thinking parasites and dewormers. Texas A&M's Dr. Tom Hargrave.
We think about dewormers as kind of bulletproof, right? We know to care for vaccines. We know that we need to keep vaccines, you know, cool. We need out of the light and stuff like that. Well, dewormers are a little different than vaccines, so we don't have to worry about necessarily keeping them refrigerated. But if they're sitting out on a bench and they're almost boiling, you know, they're getting real hot, there's going to be some issue with that dewormer. So again, just common sense. You know, it's not uncommon, especially working a lot of cattle, that we're going to, if we're using especially a, you know, a bag or a, you know, a delivery system with a tube, well, that still hangs on the chute. So we leave that, you know, we're going to be back tomorrow with some more cattle. When I pick that up, that dewormer is some of it's going to be inactivated. So again, those are things, just common sense things to think about when you're deworming. Always follow the directions. Try to stay at your top, you know, your heavier dose. In other words, you want to make sure all your cattle are covered. The other thing, there's a lot of question about pour-ons versus injectables, right? And so, in my opinion, if you using your pour-on and you're using it correctly, then they work pretty good. And that's what we're seeing in this study. We have several herds already in, and we've been able to look at some different drugs. And again, I don't think it necessarily goes back to the drug. It goes back with the resistance to your cattle to that drug.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
In 23, the U.S. Supreme Court said an employer can sidestep federal administrative agency procedures of the National Labor Relations Board and go straight to court when striking workers damage the company's property rather than just cause economic harm.
Roger McCohen is a tax law specialist at Washburn University on some big cases in 2023.
What you had in this case, it's not an ag case, but it's directly, I think, related to ag because we had a perishable commodity involved. But what you had was a concrete company that filed a lawsuit for damages against the labor union that represented its drivers. What the workers did was fill the mixer trucks with concrete that was ready to pour, knowing they were going to walk away. Well, that's a problem because that is a perishable commodity right there. If that concrete sets up, you can't use it for the job. So the company sued for damage to their property, something that is not protected under federal labor law. And the union said, well, you can't do that. You have to go through federal administrative channels first, the National Labor Relations Board. And the court said, no, this is more like an ordinary tort lawsuit. It's not a federal labor dispute. Company goes straight to court. And the key point was the court said that walking away was inconsistent with accepting a perishable commodity. And there's your tie to ag, because when we have labor disputes in ag, in those parts of ag that are unionized, which is largely in fruits and vegetables, the labor dispute is often timed to damage perishable food products like fruit and veggies. So merely timing a work stoppage during harvest, while that might not be enough to be deemed economic damage unless the union has a contract, I think that striking during a sorting line has begun, or after the sorting line has begun, would seem to be enough to say That's economic damage, and you don't have to go through, as the employer, you don't have to go through federal labor administrative procedures.
And another issue, Swamp Buster.
Yeah, Swamp Buster is the farm program that came into the mid-1980s along with CRP conservation title of the 1985 Farm Bill that says that you can't drain certain defined wet areas and grow crops on them and receive farm subsidies for doing that. So that's known as Swamp Buster. We have Sod Buster and Swamp Buster and CRP and all of that that came in the mid-80s. Well, what you had in this case in South Dakota was back in 1936, the farmer at issue, his father, planted a tree belt to prevent erosion, and that tree belt grew over the years, and it collects deep snow drifts in the winter. In other words, it does its job. The snow piles up close to the tree bank, keeps it off of the roads, keeps it off of the field. But then when the spring comes and the weather warms up, the melting snow collects in a low spot in the middle of the field before soaking into the ground or evaporate. Now, we're talking a very small spot here. This is a fraction of an acre. And in 2011, the USDA called the puddle a wetland, subject to the Swamp Buster rules, couldn't farm it, and they refused to reconsider that determination, even though they had a legal obligation to do so by statute, when the farmer presented new evidence that countered the USDA's position. In other words, he came back and said, based on the soil type, based on all your rules, your three conditions for having a wetland that are in your rules, USDA, I've got evidence that shows that it doesn't satisfy those conditions, and it's not. Well, they wouldn't reconsider. So he challenged that determination in court, as well as the USDA's unwillingness to reconsider, and he lost. And I think that's wrong, and this case has been, petition of certiorari has been filed with the U.S. Supreme Court. So we'll see if the U.S. Supreme Court takes this case in 2024.
Tax law specialist Roger McCohen with Washburn University. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Our president has spoken with President Lopez Obrador on a number of occasions. They have a very close relationship and a very close working relationship.
Speaking in Eagle Pass, Texas, on a very hot topic right now, the southern border. Alexander Mayorkas, Secretary of Homeland Security.
Our trip to Mexico was for the purpose of ensuring the commitment on both sides of the border, that we would do what we represented we would do, and that the Mexican authorities would do what they represented they would do. And they are taking a number of enforcement mechanisms, such as ensuring that their checkpoints are staffed along the migratory path, that individuals are removed from the north to the south, that individuals who can be repatriated from Mexico to their countries of origin are in fact repatriated, and that we are able to remove individuals of certain nationalities to Mexico, which we are doing. And the gentleman referred to an upcoming meeting again between leadership in the United States and leadership in Mexico, and that is scheduled for later this month.
Of course, we know when there's unrest around the world, it affects markets. Dr. Callum Turvey with Cornell.
So we started looking at this complex between the CME futures prices, Ukrainian wheat futures prices, and Black Sea wheat futures prices. We had to recognize, in order to understand what's going on here, that we just couldn't think about this as an exogenous shock that's going to be short run. And students, hedgers can trade on it on a very simple basis. The wheat markets are globally linked through spatial trade relationships, as well as local supply and demand conditions and shipping costs. What was the relationships and the information flow between the futures prices before the war? How were these three markets co-integrated with each other? How did they move together? What are the patterns or the direction flows of influence between these markets? And what I mean by that is, does the supply conditions and demand conditions in Ukraine affect the wheat prices in Chicago, or are the wheat prices in Chicago determining what the local prices are at Ukrainian ports, and so on? And so we had this sort of very complex structure where, as the war broke out, there had to be readjustments in the global wheat supply and the trading economy. And the big question is, how did these relationships change as the result of the war? And this question had come up with the trade war on soybean prices with the Chinese blockade. on that period. And what we had found then was, as the blockade increased, there was a complete disconnect between the Chicago price and the Dalian price of soybeans. And we wanted to see whether or not we can make some determination here also as to what this particular conflict would have on these prices.
And of course, agriculture in Ukraine is a big deal.
So Ukrainian agriculture, it is a very large wheat-growing area in Europe, the breadbasket of Europe, some have called it before. Most of Ukrainian land is arable, and agriculture provides about 14% of Ukraine's population. And it is also a very important exporter. Now, the global exporters are not huge relative to, say, the United States and Canada, but in the markets that it does export to, it's a very significant player in the world market.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The USDA's December Hogs and Pigs Report places the December 1st inventory of all hogs and pigs at 74.97 million head, up almost 1% from last quarter and just barely above last year, in contrast to pre-report expectations of a slightly lower inventory.
Dr. Jason Franken with Western Illinois University on the latest Hogs and Pigs report.
The slightly higher total reflects a 0.3% year-over-year increase in market hogs, which was toward the upper end of pre-report estimates, while the breeding herd declined a surprising 3.3% from the prior year, below expectations ranging only 1.7% lower. The lightest two weight classes of market hogs are each down about 0.5% compared to last year, though not as much as expected. While the heavier two weight classes are up more than expected, with the over 180-pound class nearly 2.5% higher compared to expectations of about 1% higher. Overall, there are just less than 0.2% fewer hogs weighing under 180 pounds than a year ago, and these will be the market hogs arriving at processing plants from January to May, suggesting similar supplies as last year for the period, despite expectations for greater pullback. The smaller-than-expected decline in lighter-weight hogs partly reflects that the September to November pig crop is surprisingly only 0.25% smaller than last year, as a 4% cut in sows farrowed was again largely offset by another record 11.66 pigs saved per litter, continuing the upward trend in that statistic. Hence, cuts to farrowings intended to reduce the fall pig crop and translate into corresponding reductions in spring slaughter do so to a lesser extent than expected without the productivity gains. Meanwhile, winter and spring farrowing intentions are each down about 1.25% and 1.2% respectively from actual farrowings last year, indicating further intentions for industry contraction. Cold stocks of pork remain well below pre-COVID-19 pandemic levels. According to the USDA cold storage report, cold stocks of pork on November 30th are down 5% from the prior month and 8% from a year ago. Meanwhile, poultry stocks are down 8% from the prior month, but up 3% from a year ago, while beef is up 2% from the prior month, but down 13% from last year. The USDA places U.S. per capita pork consumption at 50.2 pounds per person for 2023 and forecasts the number rising to 50.6 pounds per person in 2024, well below the pre-COVID-19 level of 52.1 pounds per person in 2019. The U.S. exported 572 million pounds of pork in October, or about 6% higher than the prior October. About 64% of those shipments went to the Western Hemisphere, with 41% going to Mexico, or about 16% more than over the same period a year ago. Meanwhile, U.S. pork exports for the period are around 43% lower to China and Hong Kong, and almost 11% lower to Japan than a year ago, with the U.S. and the EU losing share of the Japanese market to Canada and Brazil. As such, fourth quarter exports are estimated to be 1.76 billion pounds, or 4.4% greater than a year ago, bringing the total for 2023 to 6.75 billion pounds, or about 6.4% above the 2022 level. For 2024, pork exports are forecast to be almost 1.5% higher than this year. Overall, the outlook for hog prices and profitability remains bearish, at least for the near term. The forecast presented here is for the national weighted average net price on a carcass basis for all transactions for producer-sold burros and gilts, including negotiated and contract prices.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Does an extension of the existing farm bill impact the wish list created by various commodity groups and ag organizations for a new one being considered by Congress this year? One point of view is provided by Joby Young, American Farm Bureau Federation Executive Vice President.
A lot of work's been done, a lot of input and stakeholder feedback gathering has gone on over the last 18 months.
Or in some cases, 2 years to even the full 5-year length of the current farm bill. Because of that, Andy Levine of the American Seed Trade Association believes...
I'd say the cake mix is made. May not have been completely baked, but you're not going to be introducing a lot of new things in there that already haven't been debated, already discussed, maybe a marker bill somewhere out there that may pull in. But I think for the most part, the ideas have been vetted, and we've got the cake batter together, and we just need to figure out what pan we're going to cook it in.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.